Hello, and welcome to I Am The Egg Pods with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, it's a delight to welcome back journalist, author, and Emmy Award-winning screenwriter, David Quantick.
Hello, Chris. Nice to be back. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How's isolation?
Well, as a freelance writer, it's not much different to my normal life. So, yeah, in fact, I'm actually seeing more people and going out more than I normally do for my exercise. So I'm one of the lucky ones, I think. Also, I've got a vast amount of music to listen to and things to write and read. So hooray for isolation.
So the album that you've picked is John Lennon's October 1971 album, Imagine. So why did you choose this particular one?
Well, it's weird because any other artist, this would be regarded as an all-time classic, a masterpiece of melody and lyrics. But because it's John Lennon, the eternal rebel, the voice of truth, a lot of people look down their noses at it. There's a lot of snobbery about Imagine. On the one hand, you've got people singing it all around the world, looking for, I don't know, peace and beauty in life. On the other hand, you've got people going, oh, Imagine no possessions. He had two hats, you know.
Yeah.
So there's that.
It's the line that stuck with him, isn't it? So this was John's second proper album, I guess, after the previous year's John Lennon Plastic Ono Band. And sessions for this started in February 71 at Abbey Road. These were interrupted by the Beatles' High Court case, which ran throughout February and March, and which eventually went in Paul's favour. As a result of that, sessions didn't reconvene until May, this time not in Abbey Road, which John may have chosen to distance himself from, but at his home studio in Tittenhurst Park. And these were recorded on an 8-track, which he called Ascot Sound Studios, or ASS. And the sessions concluded in 71 in July, where strings were overdubbed at the Record Plant East in New York City by the Flux Fiddlers, who are members of the New York Philharmonic. Do you want a bit of context as well?
Yeah, why not? Flood me with context.
I'm going to flood you. So in January 71, George Harrison had enjoyed success with the number one single and album, My Sweet Lord and All Things Pass. And in February, George and John met up to record some tracks for Ronnie Spector. And it was here that John first heard Try Some, Buy Some, from which he later admitted he borrowed the riff for Happy Christmas War Is Over. Ringo had been filming the Frank Zappa movie 200 Motels and the spaghetti western Blind Man. Have you seen either of those?
No.
Don't.
I won't then.
In April, he'd had a hit with his and George's collaboration, It Don't Come Easy. In May 71, Paul and Ringo flew to Saint-Tropez to attend Mick Jagger's wedding to Bianca. Ringo stayed on, hired a luxury yacht, met up with George Harrison. Notably, on 21st of May, Paul and Linda released the album Ram, more of which later. And it was at this point John decided to crack on with recording his album. But I think from that, I think it's quite interesting, even a year after the Beatles had split, how they were still hanging around together.
Yeah, well, everybody apart from John and Paul, really. One of the things we'll learn about Imagine is how Beatly it actually is. And yeah, there is this idea that when the Beatles split up, they all flew away like that dreadful mural in Liverpool. You'll get letters now. But in fact, they didn't fly away. They all hung around, sued each other, played with each other, all kinds of stuff.
So this album, again, it's got George on it, would have had Ringo as well, but he was unavailable. And produced by Phil Spector, who was de rigueur throughout this season, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I could be cynical and say the less talented Beatles worked with Phil Spector, where Ringo and Paul ploughed different furrows. But yeah, I don't know. Phil Spector, very talented, but it's kind of the laziness sets in when they get Spector. But that's another story. Imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger.
So should we crack on then?
Yes.
Right, over to you. Track one, Imagine.
Imagine's one of those songs that it's so big. It's John's yesterday, you would have to say that. In fact, Mike Batt, who, of course, I co-wrote a musical with, does a brilliant party piece called Imagine Something Yesterday, in which he does a seamless medley of all three songs. Very funny. Check it out on YouTube, Imagine Something Yesterday. Yeah.
Yesterday's the day she moved. Imagine now there are no games to play. For she was like no other lover. And now there are no people. And I need a place to hide away. Imagine something yesterday.
And, you know, George has something, Paul has yesterday, Lennon has Imagine. It's the signature Lennon song. And there's so many ironies in it that Lennon, this kind of sarcastic, rough, pretty nasty man in many ways, very rich, writes this beautiful chocolate box song that even Paul would have thought twice about writing. But it's sincere in its own way. And a song can be true without being a description of the singer. You know, David Bowie was not an alligator from the moon, and so on and so forth. Imagine's a lovely tune, beautiful melody. We all go, yoo-hoo-hoo-hoo, when it comes. That amazing, deep piano riff, which just sounds like the waves rolling in. And I was really happy when I first heard a bootleg of Imagine to discover that when John Lennon sang You May Say I'm a Dreamer on the demo, he also sang You're a Dreamer! Just like everybody does who thinks they're being funny. You may say I'm a dreamer. You're a dreamer.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant tune. Its flaws are nothing to do with hypocrisy. Its flaws are that it's over familiar. And also it's associated with people we don't want to be associated with. Nice people.
Yeah. We've got so much footage because, I mean, he filmed pretty well the whole album being recorded. So it's lovely to see him introducing it to Nicky Hopkins and Klaus Bormann's on here, back from Hamburg days. And it was Klaus who suggested, why don't you play it on the big white grand piano? But originally Nicky Hopkins was going to play it on keyboard with him doing it an octave higher.
Blimey. And if you,
again, that's on YouTube. It does sound a bit Bobby Crush, to be honest. So. But John keeps saying to Phil, it just needs my piano, really. So John kind of knew what he was doing. And again, that no possessions line is, you know, that's what John was really, wasn't he? He was openly a hypocrite. And the more you know about him, or the more you read about him, you try and understand him. Well, why can't he say that?
Oh, he's also saying, imagine no possessions. He's not saying, I've got no possessions. This is the man who famously in the 60s asked about politics, said, my heart says Labour, my wallet says Conservative.
Yeah.
So he was aware. And it's like, try being a pop star with no money. You wouldn't be able to get to the gigs. You know, Billy Bragg has to catch the bus. That's not suitable.
One thing I've noticed, imagine the intro bears more than a passing resemblance to a 1965 single released by his father, Freddie Lennon, called That's My Life.
Oh, gosh, I've heard this. I must play that, yeah.
Shall I play it now while you're here?
Yeah, go on. Bloody hell. Yeah, that's quite similar. I also like that looking at the sleeve of it, we're looking at what would have happened if John Lennon had never become famous.
I'll pick up my story where I once left off. I sailed with the tides and lived on dreams. I've watched the sunrise over every ocean.
That's my life, that's my love.
That's where the similarities end.
Blimey. There's a musical talent that came out of nowhere. Must have got it from his mum, etc.
I find this period interesting because John had invited his father over the previous year to celebrate his 30th birthday. But unfortunately for his dad, it was probably the worst possible time to visit, as John was still kind of extolling the virtues of primal scream therapy. So it didn't go that swimmingly. And his dad's comments were, John launched into accounts of his recent visit to America. And as the story unfolded, so the self-inflicted torture began to show on his face. His voice rose to a scream as he likened himself to Jimi Hendrix and other pop stars who had recently departed from the scene, ending in a crescendo as he admitted he was bloody mad, insane, and due for an early demise. It seemed he had gone to America at great expense to have some kind of treatment through drugs, which enabled one to go back and relive from early childhood the happenings, which in his own case he should have been happier to forget. I was now listening to the result of this treatment as he reviled his dead mother in unspeakable terms, referring also to the aunt who had brought him up in similar derogatory terms, as well as one or two of his closest friends. I sat through it all completely stunned, hardly believing this was the kind of considerate Beatle John Lennon talking to his father with such evil intensity.
Blimey.
Families, eh?
I know. I wonder if, yeah, shocking stuff. Oh, yeah, I mean, well, it's... So, in a bit of context, so he's done the two experimental albums, very avant-garde, quite beyond a lot of what other people have done, follows it up with Plastic Ono Band, which is a fantastic record, the one that all the hardcore fans love. And it's interesting because it's, again, it's anti-Abbey Road. It's very stripped down, not really experimental. Phil Spector's famous Epic Sound, which normally involves 98 orchestras, is down to like a four-piece band. An amazing, emotional, but melodic album. And this is what he later referred to as sugarcoating the pill. Mm. This is basically a very similar album to Plastic Ono Band, but with the difference that it's got strings, it's got prettier tunes, it's still emotional, it's still quite hard-hitting at times. But it is him being pop, which he could do when he could be bothered. He does it again with Double Fantasy at the other end of his career, when he says, right, I'm actually going to, I need a hit. Whenever he needs a hit, he makes the effort. When he's, most of his 70s output is quite poor. But this is a wonderful pop record. But also, contradicting myself, a lot of it isn't. But because of this and a couple of other songs, it's got an image as his soft, almost Paul McCartney-like album.
Yeah. The one thing I noticed was Phil Spector's involvement. The strings, particularly on this song, are far more restrained than they were on Long and Winding Road.
Yeah, and I think that's probably because John's brief was very strong, whereas Paul didn't even know about the strings on Long and Winding Road. I mean, the strings on this album I'll talk about more, but there's a man called Torry Zito, who I had to look up. He was an arranger, mostly from jazz. He'd done a lot of jazz stuff in the 60s. And the strings on this are very conventional, on Imagine itself. You know, they hardly notice them. But there's a very, we'll come on to it, but there's a very distinctive string sound on this record that I want to talk about because it never gets talked about and it's bloody weird.
Track two, Crippled Inside.
Yeah, it's if you're like someone like me, I bought this album when I was fairly young because of Imagine, and it was the 70s, and I'd never heard the rest of the album. There was, you know, I had Shaved Fish. There was no big Lennon compilation in those days. So you get Imagine, you put it on, opening track is Imagine, and you're like, oh, I can't wait to, oh, Crippled Inside. And not only is the subject matter quite different to the title track, but also, it's weird. Not weird in an arty way. It's this kind of rumpty-tumpty, honky-donk, tin-tack piano tune with pedal steel where he sings it in this kind of strangulated country and western voice. I love it. It's great. But it's a bit of a step from Imagine. And it's, of course, it's sort of a hangover from the Primal Scream years. One thing you can't hide is when you're crippled inside. And it's one of those Lennon, Dylan type list songs. You can be this, you can be that, you can be the other, but punchline. I really like it, but not a lot to say about it, apart from it's a very odd moment for him. It's one of those things, I've got Nicky Hopkins on, he can play this kind of rat-ta-ta-ta stuff.
Obviously, George Harrison is flying on the Dobra slide guitar.
Well, I was going to say, it's a bit of a cousin to I Me Mine and For You Blue. It definitely...
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, you could put this song on Let It Be and George would have had a good time on it. It's interesting to hear George's contributions here because he is, despite all his moans and complaints later, very much a contributor to this record. You know, and taking a sideman role in a way that he wouldn't have accepted from Paul. Probably because John just said play, because, you know, John's interest in experiment pretty much takes a massive nosedive from this album onwards.
Because there's footage of Tarik Ali turning up, and John says, I've only actually written three new songs for this album. The rest are old ones polished up. But I don't know if you've heard a folk song called Black Dog?
No.
Oh, right, I'm going to play you this as well. See if you recognise the middle eight from this. The Beatles actually jammed this during the Get Back sessions, but I'll play you it now, hold on.
Well, now they call me a dog when I'm gone.
No, I'm
right. Now, baby, it's black dog when I'm gone. When I get home with a $20 bill, Daddy, where you been so long?
Yeah. That sounds like a Nick.
Or homage.
A homage. Those were the days. In fact, the same week that George is nicking bits for My Sweet Lord. You could do that sort of thing in those days. And now you can't.
Track 3, Jealous Guy.
Hey, yeah, I mean, love it. It's interesting because after this we get the terrible album, which is Mind Games. And Mind Games is, you may be aware of my fantastic theory that everybody had, when they have a massive hit album that defines them, the next album is a crap version of that. The obvious one is, of course, Night at the Opera by Queen. It's followed up with Day at the Races, which is a weaker version. Paul McCartney did it, Band on the Run, becomes Venus on Mars. Mind Games is a feeble successor to Imagine. But the reason I bring it up here is because the one good song on Mind Games is the title track, which was a song Lennon written earlier called Make Love Not War. And, as we all know, Jealous Guy is a Beatles song written in Rishikesh called Child of Nature, with the worst chorus ever. I'm just a child of nature, pause, I'm one of nature's children. Thanks for clearing that up, the ambiguity in the phrase child of nature there. Yeah. Jealous Guy is amazing. It's one of, I think, three John Apologizes to Yoko songs. There's this one, there's Aisumasen, I'm Sorry, on Mind Games. Yeah. And I forget the other one, but yeah, there's a quote on one of the albums as well, which is, sorry, love means having to say sorry all the time. So John obviously spent a great deal of time apologising to Yoko Ono. And yeah, of course, this was quite weird for people because Lennon, you know, he's the guy who wrote Run For Your Life. He was the guy who was quite a hard man. And suddenly he's just apologising for what he's thinking all the time. It's a massive contrast, a good thing, obviously. But the new John Lennon, the softer John Lennon, writing a song, which is probably quite almost unique at this point in pop history, just saying, I've been a tit to his wife. Yeah. and with obviously a beautiful melody. Jealous Guy, not one of the most covered Lennon songs, but certainly a biggie in terms of being covered, because it's one of his later songs that anybody could do. It could apply to anybody who's feeling a bit sensitive, even Brian Ferry.
Yeah, when you're saying about his, you know, we haven't heard this kind of John Lennon before, really. Well, certainly not throughout the Beatles. But even at the time, after he released it, you know, he was asked about this song, and he said, "It's true, I want to possess Yoko completely, but I don't want to stifle her." So he's well aware of his own weaknesses. And we've had lots of conversations on this podcast about his misogynistic lyrics in the Beatles songs. But this is like a heart-wrenching apology. But his, as you say, yeah, his voice is breaking as he's singing this. It's like he's crying the vocals.
It's one of his best vocal performances. I don't think he liked his voice. But yeah, it's probably the softest. Most of the vocals on this, there's some beautiful singing, really heartfelt, one famous exception. But it's probably the softest vocal performance he's done, and soft in a pretty way. When you look at the most naked vocal performance, is probably Julia on the White Album.
Yeah.
Where he's just doing his best to be really raw. This is a calculated pop song, but it's beautifully done. It's, you know, people always do this thing about Lennon, say blah, 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 the honest guy, etc. But this shows that he understood his pop music. It's a great pop song. It's, you know, someone like Al Green should have done it. Maybe has.
Oh, that'd be awesome. We've been a bit cruel to Phil Spector previously, but I would say the strings on this song are quite beautiful. I was trying to catch your eye.
Glissando going on, but it suits the song. It's got that kind of sparkly melody, but yeah, the strings suit the song really well here.
And Paul years later threw something into the mix saying that the song may have also been about him.
Oh god, they're always saying that, all these songs. Oh, it's about me, oh, it's about John, it's about Paul. Yeah, probably not. I think at this point in Lennon's career, because, you know, there is a song about Paul on this album, and it is...
Not that one.
Nothing like Jealous Guy, so Paul may have got mixed up.
And the song features Joey Mulland and Tom Evans from Badfinger on acoustic guitar.
Ah, cool.
And the Moody Blues' Mike Pinder, who John had invited to play Mellotron, but basically they couldn't get it working, so they just gave him a tambourine.
Oh, well, that's nice. He'd come all that way.
Yeah.
I hope he got a cup of tea. But the thing about Jealous Guy is it's not... what you call an ambiguous song in any way. I mean, it's a very naked couple, isn't it? I was feeling insecure. You might not love me anymore. You know, it's very unadorned. There's not even a simile in it.
Track 4, It's So Hard.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is one that could easily have been on Plastic Ono Band. It's very basic, very blunt. It's very Lennon chastising himself and everybody else. And I think this has got the old Flux Fiddlers on it.
Yeah.
And I wanted to talk about this because it's such... it's not written about, because and it's such an old sound. It's slightly oriental, slightly Asian sounding. I think it's an attempt to do the blues on strings. It just... you never hear it anywhere except on John Lennon records. There's one exception, which is brilliantly all Those Years Ago by George Harrison. He replicates
it. Oh,
yeah. And it's obviously a lovely tribute to Lennon.
Yeah. I've never noticed...
Yeah, my miming is going to go down really well on the podcast, but Yeah, and Flux, I'm guessing because of Fluxus, Yoko Ono's old art group, but maybe a nod to the style of play. But it's a completely unique thing that only occurs on two or three John Lennon records, maybe just this one. It works very well, and it works very well on It's So Hard, a song about which there isn't much to say, except it's not bad, it's a good album track. It would probably have been a good single for Joe Cocker, who seemed to devote his life to covering Beatles songs. But yeah.
It's interesting you say it's similar to Plastic Ono Band, because it was recorded, one of the first ones, in February 71, not that long after the previous album. So it's like he's still, yeah, I'm going to still be in that territory. Although the dynamics of the instrumentation are way beyond what happens on Plastic Ono Band.
And also those strings, again, it's the sugaring of the pill. It's a nifty number. And it's interesting that at this point, as what we would call the future laziness of Lennon, this is the man who'd been a great experimenter in the Beatles when he could get hold of acid, who pushed the frontiers of sound, but now was edging into boogie territory. Just too many 12 bars and blues type riffs, which has never been the forte of any of the Beatles. Now, there's a whole essay to be written about the Beatles, rock and roll versus R&B, blues versus soul. They were too experimental and too excited by new ideas to be a good boogie band. But at this point, John keeps trying to be a boogie band.
Which he'd fully embrace in the next album, sometime in New York City.
Oh, God. I think when I was a kid, you could buy that album for a penny. It was like, you go in the shop, see the price, and you realised how commerce worked.
We won't be expecting you back to review that one.
Oh, I don't think I could. I literally don't think I could face. I mean, put it this way. I know it's not the right album, but when you're looking forward to hearing the Frank Zappa jam side, you know there's something wrong with the record, when that's a break.
And during the sessions with this, King Curtis played on sax. He was also in I Don't Want to Be a Soldier, but it's one of his final performances, and he was murdered in a street fight just a few months later, before the album was released.
If you read Stuart Cosgrove's book, Harlem, is it 69 or 70, the third in his series about black music in the 60s, King Curtis comes over very interestingly. There's an awful lot of people on the criminal fringes, to say the least, in that book. And King Curtis is a fascinating man. But yeah, Lennon was slightly overwhelmed to have him on the record.
Yeah.
He was like, just like a kid in a candy store, King Curtis is on my record, and telling him what records he wanted to sound like. And obviously trying to impress King Curtis, oh, I've got this one. But yeah, it's a nice bit of saxophone. It works well. It's slightly corny, but then the song's slightly corny.
Track 5, I Don't Want to Be a Soldier.
This one is very, very Plastic Ono Band, but almost a bit experimental. It's got that nice bit of sound effects at the end, the sort of whoop-whoop noise, as we experts call it. But yeah, it's a great, it's literally mesmeric. It's just endless lines repeated. I've no doubt John Lennon didn't want to be a soldier, so there's a satirical element to it. It's just a great piece of dirgy, repetitive music, and yeah, probably owes a little bit to the Yoko stylings that we had just about heard for the first time the year before. I really like it. You know, it's one of the things that you could have 18 minutes of it and you'd go mad, but it would be a good 18 minutes.
You do surprise me, I have to be honest.
Why?
I didn't think, I don't know, it's, I do struggle with this song. I mean, this was actually recorded after they finished recording Jealous Guy. I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying that Jealous Guy was started pretty late at night, sort of 11 p.m. So this would have been the early hours of the following morning. And again, it was one of the ones they recorded at the beginning of the sessions back in February, and John re-recorded it. And they're both out there, so you can really hear the impact again of Phil Spector on this, because it's full-on Wall of Sound. But, it's just one of those, it was at the end of side one, so for me, it was always kind of maybe take it off just before the end.
It does show you that it's an album of two stars. It's an album with two gears. It's basically soft poppy songs with kind of grindy rock numbers. And there's not much in between. It's either beautiful songs or angry face-bashing songs. I'm sick and tired of hearing things.
So we flip over to side two. Give me some truth.
Give me some truth. Yeah. The Generation X classic. Covered by Generation X and the Wonder Stuff, bizarrely enough, because its lyrics have fitted every era. Anyone who's a bit cynical. It's a song from the Beatles era, of course. And it's a song where... Excuse me a sec. Hello. Do you want to come and say hello to Chris? Talking to Chris. Oh, he's hiding. He can't see you unless you stand in front of the camera. See, there you are. Say hello.
Hello.
I'm talking about the Beatles now. You have to go away. No way. Close the door.
I feel like I'm watching BBC News.
It's always that moment. I'll just close the door again.
Oh, it's all right. Yeah, don't worry.
So... Yeah, so it's a late period Beatles song, and it's very much from that time when they couldn't finish any bloody songs. It's the era when you've got Paul doing Teddy Boy, which is one of those, like Give Me Some Truth, another circular song that you can't get out of. And there's a few others from that time, and it's that moment you think, you should have just handed it over to Paul to just give it. It's a great piece of music because the beat drives it on. So it's like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It doesn't need to resolve. It doesn't need to change. But it's definitely something that's a Beatles reject. And it's a classic, ironically, early Lennon lyric where, once again, he's just everyone else is a wanker apart from John. In fact, there's two kinds of songs. Songs where everyone else is a wanker and songs where John is a wanker. Yeah, I mean, I really like it. It's got a massive drive. You can see why punk bands have covered it. You can see why later bands have covered it. It's, apart from the mention of Tricky Dicky, which doesn't really matter, it's an always relevant song. You know, someone could do it today and it would be an internet sensation. It certainly fits the strange vibe of Imagine, where it's half Candy Floss and half Vitriol. But yeah, it's one of the Vitriol songs on this album. It's not even about Paul.
Which is a pleasant
surprise.
Respite.
We should also mention the packaging of Imagine. Again, which goes into this Vitriol Candy Floss thing, that the cover is this beautiful image, clouds. There's a quote from Yoko, Imagine, dig a hole in your garden. And there's a postcard. And it's John holding a pig.
Yeah.
In negative tribute to Paul's ram. And it's like, just give it a rest, guys. Yeah. Seriously. But it's just this bizarre mixture of viciousness and loveliness which permeates this record.
I think the highlight for me is George Harrison's guitar solo.
Yeah, it never occurred to me it was George before, normally, because I don't normally like his guitar playing. But yeah, it's venomous. And George is generally noted for musical blandness and personal venomousness, so it's quite nice to have it that way around for a change.
Yeah, I think John was saying, you know, this afterwards, he said, you know, this is one of George's best solos. But George, being George, said, basically he wanted to redo it and redo it. And John, which I think may have happened in the Beatles.
Yeah.
And a lot of his solo stuff. But John, being John, said, no, keep it. Don't do any more takes. I'm happy with that. Whereas George would have refined it and refined it. So it's nice to hear him roar.
Well, it fits the song. Yeah, sometimes you can get George for something pretty. But yeah, raw George is not something you get much in a good form.
So we moved on to track two, Oh My Love.
Yeah. Again, one that could have totally fitted on Plastic Ono Band. Very simple piece of music. Just lovely and wistful, melancholy. Lovely suggestion of the future, you know. Oh, here comes Yoko, she saved my life. But with also the suggestion that if only it had happened earlier. Mm. You know, I'm in love for the first... I always think of Cynthia Lennon with these, when he's going, I'm in love for the first time. And it must just a horrible thing to say.
Yeah.
But, you know, Naked Honesty, stuff like that. Quite innocent love songs in a way. Nothing wrong with that.
You think of Cynthia having to listen to things like this and Don't Let Me Down. And
yeah.
Must have been literally recorded months after they split up. She must. It must have been awful for her.
Wasn't a great time.
For the first time in my life, my eyes are wide open. Oh, my lover, for the first time in my life, my eyes can see.
Yeah, but there we go. Again, one of those slightly unfit, like Love. Is Love on Plastic Ono Band?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of the counterpart to Love from that album, and one of those ones, it's not, doesn't quite sound finished. There's not a lot to it. It's a very pretty melody, and then it just sort of ends with a nice little fanfare. Da 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 da.
Yeah.
A mini fanfare. Yeah, a lovely little cameo song.
Yeah, this is George on guitar as well. And again, yeah, there's footage of them rehearsing this, and George has really got a lot of input in this. You know, he basically wrote the whole guitar piece. It's so important to this.
Oh, neat.
And again, Nicky Hopkins shines on this.
Cool. Yeah, the bizarre Stonesy Beatles connection continues.
I found, actually, I do mashups and things, but I found an old one I did of, this has nothing to do with the podcast, of We Love You. And there's software where you can filter out bits and bobs. And I've just got John and Paul doing their backing
vocals. Oh, brilliant.
I'll send you...
I'd love to hear it, yeah.
Yeah. On the single, you can kind of just make them out. But this is basically John and Paul going mental in 1967.
I'd like to hear that.
Yeah, and Oh My Love, John keeps going about the chocolate-coated Plastic Ono Band, but things like this, it's John like we've never really heard him before, just so open and bearing his soul for the world, and it's pure love for his wife.
And these are the best songs of his 70s career, are the beautiful romantic ones, because the louder bit gets a bit wearing when you've got your Power to the People and the blaring stuff, like Whatever Gets You Through the Night. But yeah, the few good songs he writes in the 70s, like Mind Games, like Nobody Loves You When You're Down and Out, and the beautiful ballads on Double Fantasy, a record I'm really starting to like as I reach senility. for songs like Beautiful Boys and Woman and Watching the Wheels. He's got a real gift for this kind of contemplative, peaceful song.
When you were writing for the NME, in that context, was it? Would you years ago dismissed Double Fantasy, say? Or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we didn't even like Paul McCartney much in those days. But, yeah, Double Fantasy was... It was slagged off at the time for being bland and a disappointment. And Lennon's death obviously made everything kind of weird in the 80s and 90s. But yeah, the conventional opinion was that John Lennon being out there was good and John Lennon being tuneful was bad. Paul was allowed to be tuneful, John wasn't, you know. Mm. And that was that. So it's only when you become old and have a family that you appreciate Lennon doing it. And again, I feel sorry for Paul, because Paul's like, oh, Beautiful Boys is a good song. Is it? Great. What about all them songs I wrote then? It would be nice to do a compilation one day, actually, just called John Doing Paul and Paul Doing John.
Oh, yeah.
I would listen to that, because, you know, the songs on Double Fantasy, Paul could have done. Not quite sure what the reverse would be, but there's probably a few.
There's Let Me Roll It, I'm trying to think now.
Just the naked Paul stuff, just the raw. There's loads of raw McCartney.
Yeah.
That's a combination. Raw McCartney and soft Lennon.
Somebody do this. Let us know. Talking of Paul, track 3, How Do You Sleep?
Oh, God. It's not quite. It is not quite an anomaly, because there are angry songs on this album, but this is one of the angriest songs ever recorded. I think Lennon at one point insanely said, "It's about Lennon," which was like, "Nice try, mate, but you can't get out of this," because lines like the only song you wrote was Yesterday, but since you're gone, you're just another day.
Yeah,
it's vicious spleen. I love it, but it should have been dumped, I think, is my take on it. It's a horrific piece of music. It's the most unpleasant venting of bile on quite shaky grounds, to be honest. Yeah, it's the one that Ringo said that Lennon had gone too far on.
Yeah.
And there's a famous bootleg version on it which ends with Lennon shouting, "How do you sleep, you cunt?" And it's like, just, it's horrific. As a piece of music, it's great. You know, all the little references, the Sgt. Pepper strings at the start to go, oh, here we go. The lyrics are nasty and personal. George, I've never really liked George much. And on this, he's enjoying himself a bit too much.
So that's the thing, isn't it? It's like this complicity against Paul. So you've got Alan Klein helped with the lyrics. Yoko helped with the lyrics.
Oh, really? So they're all shouting them out.
Phil Spector produced it. George is on there. And it does smack of bullying. But Felix Dennis was saying he was there during the sessions, during the actual composition, and he described the mood not of vitriol but of schoolboys kind of giggling at an authority figure, and they kept sort of running around with new lines. And yeah, I think that was probably how it was, but from what we hear, it's something entirely more malicious.
Makes sense to put it that way, because of course you've also got this atmosphere of sycophancy around all of the Beatles, and you know, people would be joining in. Nobody would be saying, "Do you think this is a good idea?" There's a bootleg I heard of Lennon doing Yesterday in New York. He's just arrived in New York and he's guying it, and everyone's going, "Oh, hey man, that's really funny." And like, it's Yesterday, you tosser. It's a great song.
Yeah.
And you know, everyone else, but it's just that kind of, it's one more blot on Lennon's copybook. And you imagine McCartney hearing it with that list of people, and just no wonder he had a massive drop in confidence and therefore work quality. It's a great piece of rock invective. It's a shame you can't really cover it.
I know.
I suppose if you hate Paul McCartney, you could give it a go, but...
Not many around now.
Not many of those people left.
John actually publicly thanked Alan Klein for his contribution. And to be fair, Alan Klein did do us a favour. The original lyrics, I think you mentioned it, and since you've gone, you're just another day. The original lyrics were, the only thing you done was yesterday, you probably pinched that bitch anyway. And Klein said, mate, that's libelous. So he did do us a favour there.
Oh, well, I like the idea that Alan Klein's at least worried about the legal aspects of being completely... Can't say that, it's libel.
Yeah. But you think John had no filter. So in the Beatles, he had Paul and Ringo and George, I guess, also to cut him down. But here, there was no one.
Well, this is the problem for all the solo careers. Yeah, you read in the books about McCartney that he just says to people, did you write yesterday, whenever they criticise him?
Yeah.
So the reason, one of the reasons is a drop in quality is that, you know, the only criticism they would take would be from other Beatles. Mm. And once you've fallen out with other Beatles, you're stuffed.
Yeah. It's just hard to believe that this is the sensitive man who wrote Jealous Guy.
This is the pattern emerging on this album. It really is basically, as I say, sugar followed by bile quite relentlessly.
Some have actually suggested that Paul did do a response to this, to How Do You Sleep, with his song I Lie Around. Don't know if that's true or not.
That's how bizarre. Yeah, it's quite funny. It's just occurring to me, though, talking about the sugar and bile thing. If you wanted to, you could reprogram this album and do a sugar side and a vitriol side. It'd be quite an interesting way to listen to it. One side of beautiful, like low, basically. Like Bowie's
yes,
low.
Yeah.
Do an ambient, pretty side and just a vicious side. They should do it for the next anniversary. Have a word with Yoko.
How can I go forward when I don't know which way I'm facing? How can I go forward when I don't know which way to turn?
Next, we move on to track four, How.
There's another one of those ones that could almost be a Plastic Ono band. It's a little thumbnail sketch of a melody. Really nice. And it's got one of those, in retrospect, slightly annoying lyrics, like because, one of those paradox things. How can I go forward when I can't keep going backward? How can I do A when minus A is the case? How can B occur when not B is prevalent? It's a nice little song. It doesn't really go anywhere. Doesn't really answer itself, and is also one of my new party games I haven't got round to, is counting the amount of times he says oh no in a lyric.
Oh, right.
Because he goes oh yes. No, and there's an awful lot of that. If Yoko had been called Thompson, he wouldn't have a lot of this sort of stuff. He wouldn't be singing Thompson at the end of every verse.
This is obviously, he's incredibly insecure here, which we know. There's an interesting interview with Kenny Everett in 1971. And again, it's the weird thing. John Lennon, Plastic Ono Band, wasn't as big a commercial success as he thought it would be. So still in, 71, he's still trying to promote it. But Kenny's interviewing him. Kenny, again, he's got no filter. But he's basically asking John, you've got everything. A happy marriage, beautiful mansion. So why can't we have a jolly LP?
You're not usually the happiest man of the century.
Why?
I mean, you've been through all that hell and damnation of being dragged up by the heels to the heights of stardom. And now you've sort of secured yourself in your own little studio, in your own huge house, in 70 acres of delightful scenery. So let's have a jolly LP, John.
Thank you.
Something like that?
Yeah, that'll do.
Oh, fantastic. See, could have been a single.
Could have been. But this song, it's, for me, the middle eight is one of the most beautiful things John's ever written.
That is lovely, I must admit.
You know life can be long, and you've got to be so strong, and the world is so tough.
Listening to a playback talking about this song, John asks, I'm not sure if I should use the old voice or my new voice. So it's weird, like he was making a concerted effort to change his solo voice.
Well, it's interesting that, because A, McCartney did the same thing. McCartney very much avoided sounding anything like the Beatles for a long time. And also you've got the example of Dylan, who had changed his voice. And, you know, I think in the Chronicles he says something that he'd done it really deliberately so people wouldn't mistake him for Bob Dylan or for the old Bob Dylan. And he considered all kinds of vocals. And I think Lennon would be aware of this. Yes, I am. So I was, staff. So, the changing of the voice would obviously be a big thing.
We end with Oh Yoko.
Yeah, I love it. It's really nice tune. Really nice. Oh, excuse me.
It's loading. And Daddy.
What's loading?
The movie.
This is Chris. He's saying hello. Oh.
He's
gone. I will in a minute. I think we're going to watch James and the Giant Peach in a minute.
Ah, superb.
Isolation. Different album.
Do you think this is what Lennon's song was about?
I think it was. He was predicting. Yeah, I mean, Oh Yoko, which I always get mixed up with Dear Yoko, obviously, is a lovely tune. It's that lovely piano skipping away with the harmonica. And it's nice because it's a great last track because it's basically like, and it really is credits, you know, thank you very much for coming. I really had a really good time. I'd like to thank Paul McCartney for being a wanker. You know, it's a really nice skipping away song. I think I read on Wikipedia that EMI wanted to do it as a single, Lennon said, but thought it was too pop.
Yeah.
Can't really see it being a hit. Don't know why, but it's just a nice song.
Yeah, he said he was shy and embarrassed. He didn't think it represented the image of himself as the tough, hard-biting rock and roller.
Right. Well, I suppose you could look at his singles at this point, and they are kind of a bit stompy still. But yeah, I would have chucked it out as a B-side to one of the more vitriolic songs. But it's a nice ending, and it's good that it doesn't end on a bummer for a change.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the last album ended with My Mummy's Dead, which, while wonderful, is a bit of a kind of there we go moment.
Yeah, it's not a stadium ender, is it, really?
Not really, it's not all together now. But no, it's a great ending, and it leaves you with the impression that you've been listening to a sunny album. And I think what we've learned today is that it's an illusory sunny album. It's only about 40% sunny.
Yeah. So overall, I mean, what would you say to, you know, when this album was out, I'm really struggling talking at the moment.
It's the new thing. Everyone's doing it.
So, David, thanks very much. Overall, how would you describe this album? What does it mean to you?
Well, talking about it to you, I've realised that it's not the chocolate box confection that everybody says. It's still full of the anger and viciousness of Plastic Ono Band and the Emotional Honesty. But Lennon has made it more acceptable. He has made it more melodic. It's a very strong album. I like it a lot more than I used to, and I always used to really like it. It's gone up a bit in my estimation. It's also notable because it's his last British album.
Yes.
And while bits are, you know, strings are done in New York, which is interesting, the slow move to New York, you know, let's follow the strings. It's his last British album. It's the last, you mentioned that some stuff was done at Abbey Road, the last vestiges of Britain. There's hardly an English person on it. You know, you've got German, you've got various Americans, and that era is, whereas McCartney, another, you know, McCartney, the rest of the Beatles as they're known, continued to record mostly in Britain using Abbey Road, didn't quite make the leap, whereas Lennon makes the leap quite dramatically very soon. And to be honest, things never really get better after that.
Do you think there's a difference between this album, so say John was still here, would this album still have the impact it does, do you think?
I think so, because we'd be looking back on a long life and we say, oh, it was a stage, much as we do with McCartney, you know, we say he left the Beatles, he was very low, he'd met Linda, pros and cons. We'd say this was a phase of Lennon's life, a very important one. We'd probably say things like, here we see the first seeds of the John Lennon we know today, because he'd probably be writing a few more Imagine type songs. And again, like Paul, making some terrible experimental albums in the background. Only joking, we like the Fireman. But yeah, because the thing is, when, this is pretentious, when people who were influenced by the Beatles became superstars, they're people like Elton John, not people like the Sex Pistols. So you know, they become the mirror through which we see the Beatles, just like Kraftwerk became the kind of, oh, they're not as good as the new electric bands, you know, and the same thing happens with Bowie. With the Beatles, we'd see Lennon as kind of an Elton John type ballad singer, a middle of the road person, as much as a rock and roller. I could be totally wrong. He might have gone completely avant-garde. He might have been the David Byrne of his day, working with Brian Eno. But I don't think so. So I think we'd see this as, you know, mature, his mature talents coming to the fore, still with a few chips. Good old John, you know, probably when he was 70, he'd still be making records saying that somebody was a wanker.
On that note, David Quantick, thanks so much for your
time. Thank you. I've enjoyed it.